Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 601, titled, You Gotta Be Kidding. Update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on June 24th of the year 2007. In side one, we concluded with first an examination of allegations that possibly Osama bin Laden himself may have funded the exit of some of his family members in the wake of September 11th before they could be properly interrogated, and some of them apparently were anything but innocent. And then the House of Representatives has voted to cut off aid to Saudi Arabia. There's not a lot of it, but it has some interesting uses. We're going to continue with interesting developments. In connection with the following, people should definitely get a hold of the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, and do use the vast amount of material on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com on the Muslim Brotherhood to get a grasp on what this organization is. It is, to make a very long story very short, an Islamic fascist organization that was allied with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, and one that then worked at great length for British intelligence and then mostly the CIA at the end of World War II. It was the parent organization of many of the Afghan Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda, also of Hamas, also of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and apparently among its new allies is the Bush administration. The following is by Eli Lake of the New York Sun newspaper for June 20th of 2007. It's Dateline Washington, and it reads in part, it's headlined, Bush weighs reaching out to brothers, unquote. And this is not an allusion to Jeb and Neil here. They're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, and specifically they're saying the Bush administration is quietly weighing the prospect of reaching out to the party that founded modern political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood. Still in its early stages and below the radar, the current American deliberations and diplomacy with the organization, known in Arabic as Ikhwan, take on new significance in light of Hamas's successful coup in Gaza last week. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is widely reported to have helped create Hamas in 1982. Today, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research will host a meeting with other representatives in the intelligence community to discuss opening more formal channels to the brothers. Earlier this year, the National Intelligence Council received a paper it had commissioned on the history of the Muslim Brotherhood by a scholar at the Nixon Center, Robert Lichen, who was invited to the State Department meeting today to present the case for engagement. On April 7th, congressional leaders such as Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, the Democratic whip, attended a reception where some representatives of the brothers were present. The reception was hosted at the residence in Cairo of the American ambassador to Egypt, Francis Ricciardoni, a decision that indicates a change in policy. The National Security Council and State Department already meet indirectly with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood through discussions with a new Syrian opposition group created in 2006 known as the National Salvation Front. Meanwhile, Iraq's Vice President Tariq al-Hashemi is a leader of Iraq's chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood. His party, known as the Iraqi Islamic Party, played a role in the Iraqi government since it was invited to join the Iraqi Governing Council in 2003. These developments, in light of Hamas's control of Gaza, suggest that President Bush, who has been careful to distinguish the war on terror from a war on Islam, has done more than any of his predecessors to accept the movement fighting for the merger of mosque and state in the Middle East, and also for globalization, as we've looked at in a number of programs, including For the Record shows 560 and 561. One of the most significant aspects of the September 11th investigation concerns the investigation of the money trail, in particular, as it passes through the raids of March 20th of 2002, the Green Quest raids, and the targeted SAR network, which embodies a very strong element of intersection between the Bush administration, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Bank al-Taqwa milieu, And also some of the most powerful individual figures on the Republican right, such as Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. It was a close business partner and political ally and advisor of both Georges Bush, Talat Otman, who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000, and more importantly, interceded directly with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids of 2002. One of the things to remember is that there's actually, in the midst of all of the disinformation about September 11th and all of the apathy, because it's many years later, there still is a very, very clear investigative trail following the money trail, and it is something that leads through the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was the Bush administration's ongoing and long-standing relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood through Saudi Arabia and also the intelligence community that enabled many of the things that took place on September 11th of 2001. Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I thought I would read here from Melanie Phillips' website. She's a BBC journalist, or her blog spot, I should say. And I believe, I will double-check this, I believe it's the same Melanie Phillips who was sexually harassed by Arnold Schwarzenegger. I may be confusing her with someone else. They eventually settled that suit. This particular blog spot by Melanie Phillips, a British journalist, is from June 18th of 2007. The Hamas MI6 BBC Axis, and talks about the profound links between people sort of speaking out at least obliquely on behalf of Hamas and elements of British intelligence and intelligence-connected NGOs. And it also features down in the well end of the article, it features the following, an exact quotation of sections of the Hamas Charter. And a part of it reads, "For our struggle against the Jews is extremely wide-ranging and grave, so much so that it will need all the loyal efforts we can wield to be followed by further steps and reinforced by successive battalions from the multifarious Arab and Islamic world until the enemies are defeated and Allah's victory prevails. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, the time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come and kill him. The enemies have been scheming for a long time, and they have consolidated their schemes in order to achieve what they have achieved. They took advantage of key elements in unfolding events, and accumulated a huge and influential material wealth which they put to the service of implementing their dream. This wealth permitted them to take over control of the world media, such as news agencies, the press, publication houses, broadcasting, and the like. They also used this wealth to stir revolutions in various parts of the globe in order to fulfill their interests and pick the fruits. They stood, by the way, they're talking about the Jews here, they stood behind the French and the communist revolutions, and behind most of the revolutions we hear about here and there. They also used the money to establish clandestine organizations which are spreading around the world in order to destroy societies and carry out Zionist interests. Such organizations are the Freemasons, Rotary Clubs, Lions Clubs, B'nai B'rith, and the like. All of them are destructive spying organizations. They also used the money to take over control of the imperial estates and made them colonize many countries in order to exploit the wealth of those countries and spread their corruption therein. As regards local and world wars, it has come to pass, and no one objects, that they stood behind World War I so as to wipe out the Islamic Caliphate. They collected material gains and took control of many sources of wealth. They obtained the Balfour Declaration and established the League of Nations in order to rule the world by means of that organization. They also stood behind World War II, where they collected immense benefits from trading with war materials and prepared for the establishment of their state. They inspired the establishment of the United Nations and the Security Council to replace the League of Nations in order to rule the world by their intermediary. There was no war that broke out anywhere without their fingerprints on it. Their scheme has been laid out in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and their present conduct is the best proof of what is said there. Within the circle of the conflict with world Zionism, the Hamas regards itself the spearhead and the avant-garde. It joins its efforts to all those who are active on the Palestinian scene, but more steps need to be taken by the Arab and Islamic peoples and Islamic associations throughout the Arab and Islamic world in order to make possible the next round with the Jews, the merchants of war. And that is verbatim quote from the Hamas charter. That for the benefit of people who may have just tuned in and thought that they were listening to a Pacifica fundraising pitch. No, that was the Hamas charter. Now, a major development in recent weeks has been, it's not new, but it has emerged in a big way in some of the global media, and that is the BAE scandal. That is a British defense manufacturer and was involved in massive corruption as part of a multi-multi-billion-dollar, specifically an $80 billion aircraft deal between that firm and the Saudis. A couple of the names that have emerged in connection with this are Prince Bandar, the former Saudi ambassador to the United States, a man so close to the Bush family that he ultimately earned the nickname Bandar Bush, and also the Riggs Bank. Now, the Riggs Bank was the repository for some of these ill-gotten gains. It also has been the repository for some serious ill-gotten gains for many, many, many years, and specifically the Riggs Bank and Prince Bandar have been longtime collaborators with the clandestine intelligence establishment to execute various covert operations during the Cold War and post-Cold War periods. That cooperation is detailed in, among other broadcasts, the description for the Record Program 517. There will be a description, there'll be a link to that in the description to this broadcast. Now, in addition to decades of covert operation bankrolled in part by the Saudis, the opening of the Riggs Bank and Bandar investigations might renew interest in the fact that Prince Bandar's wife was helping to fund the families of two of the hijackers who were on the plane that hit the Pentagon, and that basically she claims it was completely innocent, but those hijackers were also Saudi intelligence agents. But this is not come out because, again, Prince Bandar Bush's links to those particular people through his saintly wife have blocked any effective investigation. That is just one of the many, many interesting links of Prince Bandar. They go back for decades, and again, his nickname, Bandar Bush. Article about him in Newsweek MSNBC of June 18, 2007, from the Periscope column, we read, "Hundreds of pages of confidential U.S. bank records may be the missing link in illuminating new allegations that a major British arms contractor funneled up to $2 billion in questionable payments to Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan." The BBC and Guardian newspaper reported last week that BAE Systems made secret payments to a Washington, D.C. bank controlled by Bandar, the longtime Saudi ambassador to the United States, who is now the kingdom's national security advisor. The payments are alleged to be part of an $80 billion military aircraft deal between London and Riyadh. Last week, British Prime Minister Tony Blair acknowledged that his government shut down an investigation into the payments, in part because it could have led to the complete wreckage, unquote, of Britain's vital strategic relationship, unquote, with Saudi Arabia. I thought we were the one with the vital strategic relationship. Is it Bandar Bush or Bandar Blair? Or perhaps six of one and a half a dozen of the other. In any case, continuing, before the UK closed the inquiry, British investigators contacted the US Justice Department seeking access to records related to the Saudi bank accounts. Many of these records were first obtained by Newsweek in 2004. At the time, the magazine reported that federal regulators had been alerted to millions of dollars in suspicious activities in Saudi accounts at the now-defunct Riggs Bank. Tom Rose, a British lawyer for Bandar, denied the Saudi prince had received improper secret, unquote, commissions. He said the BAE funds were actually being paid into a Saudi defense ministry account over which Bandar had signature authority, but any payouts from those accounts, quote, were exclusively for purposes approved, unquote, by the ministry. The accounts were known both to the British and Saudi governments. A BAE spokesman said, "We deny all allegations of wrongdoing," unquote. The Riggsbank records show the use of those funds raised concerns among bank officials and U.S. regulators. In November of 2003, Riggs filed a suspicious activity report, unquote, with the Treasury Department, disclosing that over a four-month period, $17.4 million from the Saudi defense account had been dispersed to a single individual in Saudi Arabia. When Riggs officials asked the Saudis who the person was and why he was receiving the funds, they were told the individual, quote, coordinates home improvement / construction projects for Prince Bandar in Saudi Arabia, unquote, and the payments were for a, quote, new Saudi palace, unquote, one document shows. In another instance, Bandar wired $400,000 from a Riggs account to a luxury car dealer overseas. And it goes on to enumerate some of the various perks, so to speak, that have come the prince's way. The real point being, though, the covert operations that Riggs Bank and Bandar were involved with a long, long, long list of people and institutions, including the CIA and the elder George Bush and the Reagan administration and others. Last paragraph of this article by Michael Isikoff and Mark Hosenball. The controversy also raises questions about what role Bandar, a close friend of the Bush families, will play in Washington's future Mideast initiatives. Earlier this year, after consulting extensively with Bandar, U.S. officials pushed for a new Mideast peace summit, only to learn that later, Saudi King Abdullah was not on board with the plan. Since then, Bandar, apparently out of pique at being overruled, has largely dropped out of sight, according to three U.S. officials who asked not to be identified talking about sensitive diplomatic matters. One source close to the Saudis, who also asked not to be identified, said that Bandar spent much of the spring at his $135 million mansion in Aspen, Colorado, and that he is now back in Saudi Arabia. U.S. officials say they can't confirm this. It's all something of a mystery to us, unquote, said one official. So Bandar is a focal point of some very, very, very interesting goings-on indeed. Now, one of the things that we've spoken about in connection with the Islamist milieu, including al-Qaeda and other related organizations or spin-offs, as it is now aged and dissipated to a considerable extent, is the involvement of the Islamist milieu, like so many intelligence and criminal organizations, with the drug traffic. Interesting article from the London Observer of May 13th of 2007. Cannabis cash, quote, funds Islamist terrorism, unquote. It's by Alex Duval Smith in Paris, again, Sunday, May 13th of 2007. It reads in part, "Cannabis smokers are unwittingly funding Islamist extremists linked to terror attacks in Spain, Morocco, and Algeria, according to a, no pun intended, joint investigation by the Spanish and French secret services. The finding will be seized on both by campaigners for a harsher clampdown on cannabis and by those who argue that legislation is the only way to end a petty dealing trend that is dragging growing numbers of teenagers into crime. The investigation by the Centro Nacional de Inteligencia and Renseñamientos Generales were launched after Spanish police found that the Islamists behind the March 2004 bombings in Madrid bought their explosives from former miners in return for blocks of hashish. The bombings claimed 191 lives. Spain's role as a transit point for drugs was highlighted last week when Madrid hosted the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency's annual conference. Experts heard not only that North African hashish was funding terrorism in Europe, but also that West Africa had become a new hub for South American cocaine shipments bound for Europe. Morocco is the world's leading cannabis exporter, with an annual crop estimated to be worth at least £2 billion. We've examined not only vice, but organized drug smuggling in connection with the September 11th milieu in a numerous number of contexts, including and especially in connection with the Huffman Aviation milieu in South Florida, investigated by Daniel Hopsicker and serving as the transit point, the entry point of September 11th elements, including and especially Mohammed Atta. Among the agencies that elements of which have long collaborated with drug smuggling is, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency, by no means unique. Many intelligence services have engaged in the drug traffic to one extent or another. There was an interesting aspect that didn't get a lot of publicity to the recent arrest on alleged terrorism, on terrorism charges, of some people in connection with an alleged plot to blow up fuel lines at Kennedy Airport. The particular fellow who is discussed here, a fellow named DeFreitas, had worked worked as a cargo handler at Evergreen Airlines. A subsidiary, I should say, of Evergreen Airlines. Now, that is a CIA air proprietary. Again, Mohammed Atta and company infiltrated into South Florida through some of these protected drug networks. They haven't been touched. And an article that raises, or a point of investigation that raises more questions than it answers, taking a look at the Oceanside, this is specifically the Union Tribune, the San Diego Union Tribune, for December 2nd of 2004. This particular article is called Oceanside Spruce Goose and the CIA, and it's about bringing the spruce goose, or attempts to bring it, to San Diego. Skipping down, National Graphic, by the way, Spruce Goose was a giant wooden airplane built by Howard Hughes. National Graphic was going to pay us for the rights of a documentary program of the event, Rhodey emailed me recently. The Dome was going to come by large barges and sectioned up here for a movement to its final position. The Smithsonian Museum backed the position of the plane here in Oceanside because it was a big part of the aircraft industry of World War II. In the end, Oceanside finished second in the bidding, beaten by Evergreen International Aviation, Incorporated. The issue turned into a moot point, Rhodey recalled, as Delford Smith of Evergreen Airlines, the CIA's contract airline that replaced Air America of the Vietnam era, worked an insider deal with the Aero Club of Southern California, the Goose's owner, and came out as the first choice on their list, unquote. Described here as the successor to the well-known Air America, deeply involved with the narcotics traffic. Now, of Mr. DeFreitas, the key figure in the Kennedy plot, this from Newsday of June 4th of 2007, article or column by Alfonso Castillo, profile of DeFreitas, suspect's roots never took hold here. Skipping down, we read, DeFreitas was hired by a cargo transportation company at Kennedy Airport, Watts said. Documents show he was employed as a trainee supervisor, unquote. Documents show he was employed as a trainee supervisor, unquote, in 2001 with Evergreen Eagle, a subsidiary of Oregon-based Evergreen International Aviation. Officials there declined to comment. So again, DeFreitas, working for a subsidiary of Evergreen. It's interesting to recall that, as we discussed in For the Record 560, and we've talked about it in other programs as well, but the fact that Islamist organization, specifically the Muslim Brotherhood, is viewed as by no means an unworkable business ally because of its corporatist economic philosophy, originally in the World War II period, modeled on Mussolini's corporate state. An interesting footnote to the fact that not only is the Bush administration cuddling up to the Muslim Brotherhood, but recalling the Hamas charter endorsing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, not an Islamic document at all, coming from Europe, not from the Muslim world. Consider the following, and we'll also put a link here to an article which talks about the very interesting BBC link of people who have been speaking up, the very, very, very important MI6 links, I should say, of people in the BBC who've been speaking up on Hamas's behalf. Hamas, it should be said, is perhaps reciprocating the goodwill. We're going to conclude with an article from Reuters of Friday, June 22nd of 2007. This article, Hamas says it will not block Gaza natural gas deal. The Islamist group Hamas said it will no longer hinder plans to drill for natural gas off the shores of the Gaza Strip after it took control of the coastal territory a week ago, a Hamas official said on Friday. Sami Abu Zuri, a senior Hamas official, said the group would not block an agreement between British gas producer BG Group PLC and the Palestinian Authority to drill for reserves discovered off Gaza's coast in 2000. But Hamas would like to change some parts of the deal reached between BG and the Palestine Investment Fund, or PIF, which is controlled by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, that Abu Zuri said, quote, harm Palestinian interests, unquote. Hamas routed the Western-backed Abbas's Fatah faction during a bloody takeover of Gaza. Under the current government, BG plans to sell the natural gas to Israel. Britain and other Western countries have isolated Hamas because of its refusal to recognize Israel and to renounce violence. There will not be a problem to cooperate with the British company, but it is important to reconsider some things in this matter, Abu Zuri said. In December 2000, BG completed drilling a natural gas well offshore Gaza, indicating possible reserves of around 1.4 trillion cubic feet, which the PIF said has an estimated value of 1.3 billion. BG was unavailable for comment. It is premature to discuss whether Hamas wants to begin direct negotiations with the British company over drilling natural gas off Gaza shores, Abu Zuri said, but he added, we do not want to overturn existing situations. So, you know, there's a little protocols. As long as there's an aisle on the waters, as they say. So Hamas is going to let that particular deal go through. The British are certainly not hostile to it. And neither, apparently, at least past the point, are the Israelis, because that gas is going to get sold to the Israelis. Okay? Again, Hamas, whose chapter quotes from the protocols of the or references the protocols of the Elders of Zion, is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, turning back now to the book The Enemy of My Enemy, subtitled The Alarming Convergence of Militant Islam and the Extreme Right by George Michael. We read, the genesis of the cooperation between militant Islam and the extreme right can be traced back to the early years of the Third Reich. During World War II, much of the Islamic world sympathized with the Axis alliance. Members of the Muslim Brotherhood would often say prayers for an Axis victory during their meetings. Moreover, some Muslims went so far as to fantasize over putative Islamic affinities of fascist leaders. For example, rumors abounded that Benito Mussolini was in fact an Egyptian Muslim whose real name was Musa Nili, Moses of the Nile, and that Adolf Hitler, too, had secretly converted to Islam and bore the name Haider, or the Brave One, unquote. The Islamic Fascist Alliance was best exemplified by the cordial relationship between Hitler and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini. Perhaps no other figure did more to foster ties between right-wing extremism and militant Islam than he, as his ideology informed both pan-Arabism and militant Islam. And the Grand Mufti, very close to, among others, Ahmed Huber, who spoke as follows in an interview. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, whom I met in 1965 in Beirut, we had a long talk. He told me many, many interesting things because he had an almost friendship relationship with Adolf Hitler. And then goes on to relate to some niceties about their relationship. One of the things that caused these elements to be perpetuated in the post-war period was the anti-communist card, which elements of Western intelligence, including the British intelligence and elements of CIA, willingly played for decades, basically using the Muslim Brotherhood and related elements against communists and the former Soviet Union in particular. This, however, concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program 601, titled, You Gotta Be Kidding, a subtitled update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on June 24th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.